So today we're diving back into our Believe series. Remember, if you were here at the beginning of this deal, we talked about that this year for 30 weeks, we were going to be spending 30 weeks in a Believe sermon series. And I know that that can be overwhelming to some, or a never-ending to some, but we did 10 weeks, and then we took a break. We had the Easter season where we took a look at the events throughout the Easter season through Peter's eyes, but we're diving back in today, and we're going to be going for another 10 weeks. The previous 10 weeks exposed us to some key beliefs, right? Some key beliefs that aligned our thinking and allowed us to begin thinking like Jesus. Because that's what this is all about. It's about you and I thinking, believing, acting, and becoming like Jesus Christ. And so those are what the first 10 weeks we looked at. The next 10 weeks that we're kicking off with today, we're going to examine, and we may be even be introducing some of you to some key spiritual practices that aid in moving. We have these beliefs, but sometimes the beliefs just are right here. Right, they end up being just cognitive. And so the spiritual practices that we're going to talk about over the next 10 weeks are going to aid us in moving our belief from just our head to our heart. Okay? And they're going to help us to begin acting more like Jesus. All right? So here's the question in our Believe series. We have these questions that just kind of prompts, and it leads to our theme. So here's the question. How do we honor God in the way he deserves? I mean, that's a really, really important question, right? We've had a lot of great questions, a lot of important questions, but how do we honor God in the way that he deserves? Which leads to the first of these 10 weeks theme, and the answer to that is worship, right? That's the way that you and I, that's the way that we can honor God in the way that he truly deserves, is we worship him. Now, what does that mean? Right? Because that's what everybody automatically, okay. So what does that mean? You know, so the better I sing, the better I worship? I don't think so, right? So it's a lot more than just that. So here's a simple definition. Simple definition of worship, if you're trying to figure out, I kind of know what it is. Maybe you're confused and you think worship is a service. Well, right, we go to worship on Sunday morning. So you get confused and you think that a time frame, 10 to 11:30, is worship. I mean, I hope worship is going on, but we don't want to just confuse it as being a timeline or we're going to go to the building and we're going to worship. Don't want us to get confused that a location or a place is where it takes place. Okay? So here's a simple definition. You ready? You might be shocked that you're doing this. You might be even more shocked who and what you're doing this to. Simple definition of worship is this: attributing worth to someone or something. So pause and think about that right now. Right? What would your checkbook tell us you're worshiping? Right? What does your schedule tell us you're worshiping? Right? I mean, worship is simply that. It's attributing worth to someone or something. And whether that is through singing, speaking, or some kind of physical expression, when you and I declare that God is worthy, that's worship. Right? And so we can do that in a lot of different ways. So I got some more questions that are just my questions, not so much the series question, but so do we believe God is worthy? I mean, let's think about it. Do we believe God is worthy? I mean, is God worthy of our time? Right? I don't know. Do we demonstrate that? Right? Is God worthy of our attention? Is God worthy of our energy? Only you could answer honestly whether he has your time, attention, and energy or not. And maybe some of us, if we were to get honest, we would find out that God is here and there's a whole bunch of other stuff that are here. That there's a whole bunch of other stuff that is getting more of our energy, our attention, and our time than God is. That's just a simple definition. I like to express it this way. You guys have heard me say this before. You've heard me say this. I'll say it in prayer a lot of times. It's my way of kind of expressing a worship or how I define it. And I define it as when we're focusing our mind's attention and our heart's affection on God, then we're worshiping, right? And that can be in any place. That can be by ourselves. It can be with a group of people. It can be a small group of people, a large group of people, right? And it can be in all kinds of different dynamics. But when you and I are focusing our mind's attention and our heart's affection on God, that's worship. So between this morning service and tonight's gathering, I hope that three elements of worship emerge. So if you're going to be here again tonight, I hope you do. I know it would be a lot to ask you to come to church twice. I mean, that's a lot of time to consider God worthy of. I mean, I don't want to take too much of your attention or energy. I mean, you might accidentally worship something like God. Right? I mean, we got people that can't make time to ever come to a church service, but daggone, they can travel anywhere in the world. Somehow they got time. And I heard they didn't have time. They told me, well, it's just we're so busy. We're having a hard time. Really? Wow. I better leave that alone. Here's three elements, though. Here's three elements of worship that I hope emerge between this morning and this evening, and that is this, because I think they're critical elements of worship, and that is one, authenticity. Authenticity is huge. The second element, vulnerability. Vulnerability. And the third one is community. Those are three critically important elements of worship. Authenticity, vulnerability, and in community. So this morning I want us to take a look at an Old Testament episode. And I think this is one that you may be familiar with. And some, it may be an episode that even kind of bothered you a little bit. Might have even made you mad. I don't know. Depends on how easy you get mad. Right? But I think that it speaks to one of the elements of the three that I have just shared, and one in particular. So if you open up your programs, if you got your Bibles, you can look on the screen. There's two books here that I'm jumping back and forth between, 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles this morning. You know, if you're reading through Scripture and you're reading through the Old Testament and you start hitting like 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and you kind of get bored and you go, I don't want to read the next one. It's talking about the same thing over again, right? Well, you're right. It is, but it's valuable for you to read because it talks about the same events, but from different angles. And it brings different aspects or different nuances or details to light on the same events. Okay? So 2 Samuel chapter 6 is talking about the same events as 1 Chronicles chapter 15. But they're going to talk about different details. It's going to bring different details into focus. Okay, so 2 Samuel chapter 6, verses 3 through 7 says this. They placed the ark of God on a new cart and brought it from Abinadab's house, which was on a hill. Uzzah and Ahio, Abinadab's sons, were guiding the cart that carried the ark of God. Ahio walked in front of the ark. David and all the people of Israel were celebrating before the Lord, singing songs and playing all kinds of musical instruments, lyres, harps, tambourines, we'll come back to that, castanets, and cymbals. But when they arrived at the threshing floor of Nacon, the oxen stumbled, and Uzzah reached out his hand and steadied the ark of God. And then the Lord's anger was aroused against Uzzah, and God struck him dead because of this. So Uzzah died right there beside the ark of God. Now, a couple things I want to back up. We'll get to that because I know there's some people like, man, that ain't right. That's messed up. Dude was just trying to help, right? We'll get to that. Hold on. I want to back up to, let's talk about the ark of God. So if you're not familiar, I mean, somebody's watched Indiana Jones somewhere along your life, right? You know, if you don't know about it from scripture, you're like, oh yeah, that's that thing Indiana Jones they were going over. And when they touched it, like it sucked their eyeballs and everything out and they ended up as skeletons, right? So some of you guys got that. Okay, so you haven't seen the movie, you need to watch it. Wow, you have no life. So anyway, you certainly didn't have much of a childhood, but anyway. So here's the thing, the ark of God, real quickly, this is something that God had created. This is something that God mandated. This wasn't man's idea. This was God's idea. And so he had the craftsman make this box, right? So it's basically not specific. I could get into the fractions because it was all about fractions. That's a whole other thing too. But anyway, let's just say it's a 4 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot box, right? Chest. Pretty simple. Except this 4 foot by 2 foot by 2 foot box is going to be lined or overlaid with gold inside and out. That makes the box substantially heavier. I don't know if you realize that or not. And worth a lot more. Right? And then it's going to have rings attached to it. Gold rings are going to be attached to it. And then there's going to have these long poles that are also going to be overlaid with gold, completely overlaid with gold. And they're going to be slipped through those rings, and this is how this box is going to be carried around. Now, that's not it, because then the box needed a lid. And so a lid was made for this 4 foot by 2 foot box, but the lid is solid gold. So 4 foot by 2 foot piece of solid gold. We don't know how thick, maybe half inch, maybe three quarters. I don't know. Solid gold. Oh, yeah, and on top of that lid are two solid gold cherubim, right? You know, with the wings and all that and looking down, and they're facing in. You guys have seen pictures of this somewhere along the line. These are solid gold. So the lid is solid gold. The cherubim are solid gold. The box is overlaid with gold inside and out. The poles are gold. The rings are gold. This box is getting pretty expensive. And it's getting pretty heavy. And inside this box are going to go some important things. Ultimately, three things will end up inside of this box. Aaron's staff. Aaron was the priest, and it was his staff that budded, declaring that he was the rightful person to be the priest, right? His staff will be placed inside of the ark, this box. A jar. We don't know. Maybe it was a jar. I don't know how big the jar was, but it was a jar of manna. Right, the amazing, miraculous food that God provided for them throughout their entire journey in the wilderness. A jar of manna will go inside this box. And then the stone tablets on which God wrote his commandments, the Torah, right? And those stone tablets are going to go inside the box. This is getting heavier all the time, right? Well, this box, God says that he will dwell on the lid of this box in between the two cherubim. That his presence is going to manifest right there. So this box represents God's presence. And it would be placed in the holiest place in the tabernacle and eventually in the temple. You could consider it God's footstool. He he's sitting on his throne, and the ark acts kind of as his footstool, and his presence is in between those two cherubim. Now, this is considered the most sacred, holiest object because of God's presence. They brought it into battle. They carried it before them when they crossed over the Jordan into the promised land. Very significant, very important. Well, as this story unfolds, David becomes king of all Israel. And he decides, because they lost it. Not that they misplaced it or forgot where it was. They lost it in a battle because they weren't being obedient to God. And so the ark fell into the enemy's hands, but it didn't bear well for them because God's presence didn't work well for them because they weren't following God. So it actually was ill-fated for them. So they tried to get rid of the thing, get rid of it. Right? And there's a whole story behind that. So the nation of Israel had been without the ark representing God's presence. And so when David became the king of all Israel, he decided it was time to get that ark back into their possession, representing and symbolizing God's very presence among his people. So, you did make note, though, of the tambourines. I'll get back to that. So, this guy Uzzah, right? I mean, he's just trying to help. Uzzah, I mean, he sees the thing. They're on a cart. They're carrying it on a cart. They're coming down a hill. It's giving us all these details. It's a house on a hill. They're coming down the hill. They got oxen. The oxen gets to the threshing floor, and all of a sudden, the oxen stumbles. And so the wagon kind of, right, shimmies and shakes. And Uzzah, just trying to be a good guy, right, reaches out to steady it. And God strikes him dead. And we're like, man, that's like a mean God. What is his problem? Right? I mean, I know you all have heard this story before and always wondered that and been like, I don't understand the point of that. I don't get that. God was just trying to help. God strike him dead. What is that? Right? Well, you will find, if you write this down, I'm not going to tell you all the detail. You need to find it. But in Exodus chapter 25 and Numbers chapter 4, for those of you that want to check, make sure I ain't lying. In Exodus chapter 25 and Numbers chapter 4, God is very clear. And he is very specific. Not only in how this is to be built and how it is supposed to be taken care of, he's very specific on how it's supposed to be moved. He made it very clear that there is only a certain group of people that are supposed to ever have responsibility for taking care of this ark and ensuring its delivery from one location to another. Not just anybody, but only a specific people. And it's a specific people within the tribe of Levi, which the Levites were the priestly tribe. And more so than just that, God made it very clear. He says very specifically, even those who have the responsibility for caring for the transport of the sacred items, they are never, ever to touch it. He made it very clear repeatedly. Do not touch these items. And especially not that, because that's where my presence is. Because see, God's presence is wonderful. And God's presence is powerful. And he made it very clear. So, let's look on 1 Chronicles 15. So things go bad. The ark stays there for a while. They keep it at this other guy's house. Oh, by the way, the guy's house they left it at, oh man, everything went good for him. Right, crops started excelling, man. I mean, he had a bumper crop year. Everything went good at his house. Bank accounts were filling up. I mean, he was just blessed, blessed, blessed. And as this dude is being blessed, even more so, David is now going, yeah, we need to get that thing. Right, we need to get that back. We need God's presence with us because, I mean, this dude's getting blessed and because of God's presence. Right? So here we go, 1 Chronicles chapter 15, in verse 13, he says this. Now this is David. He has gathered everybody together. Now he's gathered the right people. And he says, because you Levites did not carry the ark the first time, he's not blaming them, he's just stating the fact. Because you Levites did not carry the ark the first time, the anger of the Lord our God burst out against us. We failed to ask God how to move it properly. So the priests and the Levites purified themselves in order to bring the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to Jerusalem. And then the Levites carried the ark of God on their shoulders with its carrying poles, just as the Lord had instructed Moses. So, I will tell you this. If women had been in charge, this would have never happened. Right? You could say amen on that, right? If women had been in charge, this would have never happened. This entire thing, Uzzah, this whole deal went wrong because people could not follow instructions, read instructions, or follow direction or ask for direction. Now, you tell me that ain't a man involved, that's a man involved, right? I mean, you know, Dave got mad. They're all mad because God's killed Uzzah, and God's saying, did you read the instructions? Well, no. Did you ask for directions? Well, no. Shut up. Right? That's what it is. I'm just telling you. Maybe, just maybe, this could be a principle we could adopt. Maybe, you know what? Maybe we should ask God before we do something. You know what I'm saying? Maybe, just maybe. No matter how huge or how insignificant we might think it is, maybe we should just ask God before we do something. Anyway, it goes on. 1 Chronicles chapter 15. So then David and the elders of Israel and the generals of the army went to the house of Obed-Edom to bring the Ark of the Lord's covenant up to Jerusalem with a great celebration. And because God was clearly helping the Levites as they carried the Ark of the Lord's covenant, they sacrificed 7 bulls and 7 rams. That's an incredibly important verse. We're going to come back to that. David was dressed in a robe of fine linen, as were all the Levites who carried the Ark, and also the singers and Kenaniah, the choir leader. David was also wearing a priestly garment. So all Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord's covenant with shouts of joy, the blowing of ram's horns and trumpets, the crashing of cymbals, and the loud playing on harps and lyres. Please make note that now that they're doing it the correct way, there are no tambourines. It is biblical, folks. It is biblical. We're going to let you slide because you got it with a pedal attached to it. A tambourine that is not secured on somebody's foot or has a pedal to it has no business, right? It's biblical. It's right there, okay? But as the ark, verse 29, but as the ark of the Lord's covenant entered the city of David, Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked down from her window. When she saw King David skipping about and laughing with joy, she was filled with contempt for him. So, before addressing this huge supposed scandalous situation with David, I want us to go back to verse 26. This is huge. And we read right by it. We blow right by it, and we get into, oh, okay, wait a minute. Yeah, this is the story. That's right, where David says, you know, I'm going to dance, and I'm going to leap, and I don't care if I look stupid or anything. And we get into this whole scandal, you know, and is he naked? Was he dancing naked? What's going on? You know, and we blow right by the most important verse in that passage. Verse 26. And because God was clearly helping the Levites as they carried the Ark of the Lord's covenant, they sacrificed 7 bulls and 7 rams. That should have gotten our attention. They're not going to sacrifice 7 bulls and 7 rams, you know, just going, oh, it, you know, God's good. No, no. Something major, something significant is happening with that statement that God is clearly helping the Levites carry the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of God. Here's the thing. Different scholars may disagree over the exact figure. But most scholars believe that this box, overlaid with gold inside and out, with gold rings attached to it, with a solid gold 4-foot by 2-foot lid and 2 solid cherubim above them, with solid gold overlaid poles on either side, filled with 2 stone tablets, a jar of manna, and Aaron's rod, weighed between 1,800 and 2,500 pounds. 4 men weren't going to carry it, ever. The only way you're going to carry the ark is with God's help. See, David tried to get some guys that weren't even supposed to be the guys to move the ark. And David and them put it on a cart, which it was never supposed to be moved with a cart. God commanded that it would only be moved on the shoulders of the Levites by those poles. And he meant what he said. And he had explained it to them clearly. But when they failed to read the instructions, when they failed to inquire of God for direction, they reaped the result. See, there's a great, beautiful rabbinic statement, ancient rabbinic statement, because of the fact I just told you, between 18 and 2,500 pounds. The rabbis always said that we don't carry the ark. The ark carries us. Folks, the ark represents the presence of God. It was the very presence of God. You and I don't carry the presence of God. The presence of God carries us. See, the lesson is the only way it works is when we do it God's way, with God's help, right? God's way with God's help is the only way we ever move his presence. We need to think about that. Only God's way with God's help can his presence be moved. Think about that. You and I don't move the ark, right? The ark moves us. They didn't carry the ark. The ark carried them. The only way it was possible for 4 priests to carry that down into the Jordan and across, to carry it into battle, was because God was clearly helping them. And that was God's kind of affirmation. I got this. Come with me. Right? So, continue on with 2 Samuel. Verse 6. Oh, wait a minute. We didn't get to the scandal. I'm sorry. I almost forgot the scandal. King David, right, says he was dressed in a robe of fine linen. So here's the thing. King David is leaping and skipping and dancing and laughing, right? But he's doing it in priestly garments. This is a big deal. David has just conquered Jerusalem, and he is now the king of all Israel, right? And now the king is also operating as a priest, right? He's dressed in the priestly garments. Folks, this was a linen garment that went all the way down to here. Started at the shoulders. It had all kinds of gold emblazoned on it and all kinds of stuff. And then it says he has a priestly garment. That's important because there was a certain undergarment that the priest had to wear. We would call it boxer briefs today, right? Truth be told, linen had to go from the waist down to the bottom of the thigh. That was underneath the ephod, is what he was wearing, was the linen robe. So David wasn't out of the order in any way from what he was wearing. He wasn't naked. He wasn't doing anything that would have been vulgar, right? What was considered was, here is a king humbling himself, taking off his crown and his kingly robe, and all the stuff that says who he is, and he's taking on a priestly garment, a servant garment, and he's dancing before the Lord. Humility. Humility. The king was willing to humble himself before the Lord. And you know what that required? Vulnerability. yourself vulnerable in front of everybody. Vulnerability not regarding what others would think, but solely concerned. He was solely concerned with expressing worth to God. So, how did it fare when he got inside the house? 2 Samuel 6, 20 through 23 says this. When David returned home to bless his own family, Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet him. She said in disgust, "How distinguished the king of Israel looked today, shamelessly exposing himself to the servant girls like any vulgar person might do." Man, if we listened to her description, I mean, you'd have thought he was out there dancing naked and acting a fool. You ever notice that sometimes people have a way of kind of over-embellishing things when they're describing it, especially when they're ticked? Right? David retorted to Michal, "I was dancing before the Lord." He did put a dig in here, got to say it. "Who chose me above your father and all his family?" Sorry, I mean, Dave just kind of threw it in there. "Hey, Lord chose me, y'all suck, but that's the way it is." Right? "He appointed me as the leader of Israel, the people of the Lord, so I celebrate before the Lord." Yes, and he says, "I am willing to look even more foolish than this, even to be humiliated in my own eyes. But those servant girls you mentioned will indeed think I am distinguished." So Michal, the daughter of Saul, remained childless throughout her entire life. I'm not saying that's the consequence for everybody that can't have a child. Don't think that or take it that way. But the scripture is making it very clear that in this instance, absolutely. Her attitude. Think about it. Both David and Michal, both of them are witnessing the presence of God through the ark of God being brought back into the midst of the kingdom. They both are present, right? They're both witnessing it. They're both witnessing and are present for the celebration. But they got two different attitudes about it. One is so fixated on God, he's willing to make himself vulnerable. The other, I guess, is so distinguished that she looks down in disgust. I want to share with you an interesting quote from Brené Brown. I don't know if you're familiar with Brené Brown. She's an author and a researcher. Actually, this is one of the most well-known TED Talks, if you ever watch any of those. She did a TED Talk on vulnerability, the power of vulnerability. I just thought it was interesting. I want you to hear this. We need to hear this, because some of us wrestle with this right here, right in this forum. Some of us wrestle with this in groups or classes. Brené Brown says, this is after years of research with thousands of people trying to figure out. She started out trying to figure out what it is, how do certain people are able to overcome shame? How can certain people break free and get freedom from shame? She didn't look for this conclusion. In fact, it was counterintuitive to everything she thought beforehand. But where she landed was that the only way to gain freedom from shame was through vulnerability. She says this, "Vulnerability is not weakness." See, I think Michal was looking at David with disgust because she was going, "Oh, man, he just... what's he doing?" Brené Brown says, "Our willingness to own and engage with our vulnerability determines the depth of our courage. It takes courage to be vulnerable. It's not weakness, it's courageous. Vulnerability determines the depth of our courage and the clarity of our purpose." Now here's the other side. Maybe you're more familiar with this. The level to which we protect ourselves from being vulnerable, we should probably, let me just sit there for a second. See how many faces just roll right through the Rolodex of my mind. It safe to sit in a forum where I don't have to share. The level to which we protect ourselves from being vulnerable is a measure of our fear and disconnection. The people who don't share, the people who don't share, the people who refuse to be vulnerable are the people who are disconnected emotionally and have the greatest fear. Their lives are controlled and directed by fear. The people who are free from fear and free from shame are the people who have the courage to share. Vulnerability. See, she concluded at the end of this that the extensive research, again, that the answer to being delivered from our shame was embracing vulnerability. David, King David, the king of all Israel, the king who united the entire country, the king who was king over for 33 years, the king who returned the ark, whose son built the temple, the king who's held above every other king in that nation, embraced vulnerability in his expression of worship. And as a result, he felt no shame. And when Michael tried to give him some, he refused to receive it. So I just wonder, how vulnerable we are willing